This is the Man Up Podcast, the doctor's guide to men's health. Each week on our podcast, we interview the top specialists of the field on various topics in men's health. You have questions that you are too afraid to ask, we have the answers. This week, our episode is titled, Removing the Wonder from Going Under. I'm Dr. Kevin Chu, and I'm joined as always with my co-host, Dr. Justin Dubin. Justin, it's been a pretty good week for you, hasn't it?
Been a good week. Officially moved into my new apartment in Miami, so I can see that. Yeah, I'm in the corner of my kitchen. I don't even have a desk yet. I don't have all my furniture, so I'm trying to get it all moved in. So it's been a good week.
Fantastic view, though. Fantastic
view. Oh, it's a good view. It's a good view. But you know,
the Miami mental skyline health aspect is quite beautiful.
It is a beautiful view. You had some of that view when you were living here too.
Yeah, absolutely. But also on another note, one of these good studies was put out by yourself and your team over at Northwestern, kind of looking at some stuff on testosterone, correct?
Yeah. So really excited about this paper. It came out into the Journal of America, JAMA. And basically what we did was we looked at direct-to-consumer testosterone replacement therapy platforms, companies online. And as we all know, testosterone companies or testosterone is really rising in popularity for treatment. About 12% of guys under 40 have actually been offered or been on testosterone. But there are inherent risks, and testosterone is really not for everyone. And especially in this age of direct-to-consumer marketing, these companies, I'm not going to say the company names, but there's a lot of companies out there that are currently treating men's health issues like ED, hair loss, and now testosterone. But there are concerns. You know, the difference really here is that testosterone, unlike treating you for Viagra or Cialis, or a hair loss medication, although we've already discussed the risks and benefits of those meds on this podcast, testosterone can cause infertility. And when we talk about infertility, especially in younger men, a lot of guys that, you know, Kevin sees in his clinic, I've seen in my clinic, they don't know about those risks. So what we did was we did a secret shopper for these online telemedicine platforms looking that you know, provided the service of testosterone replacement therapy. And I was actually the secret shopper. Basically, what I did was I pretended to almost be myself, you know?
You were the secret shopper.
I was the secret shopper. I played a 34-year-old man who had symptoms of low testosterone, like erectile dysfunction, low energy, low libido. And I went to, I basically tried to get consulted. I got consulted by 7 platforms, and basically got the blood work up, went through the initial evaluation, and we kind of compared what their, you know, counseling was, their evaluation of me, and their management and recommendations for me were compared to the urology and the endocrine society guidelines. And, the results were actually somewhat surprising, you know. Of the 7 companies, first off, I have to say that my testosterone levels were completely normal.
Really?
It's in the paper. 675, no big deal. Pretty good, actually. Very good levels. But listen, my levels were normal. But despite this, in the history, I also desired fertility. So despite the desire for fertility and having normal testosterone levels, 6 of the 7 companies offered me testosterone replacement therapy. Not only that, 3 out of the 6 that did offer it, 50%, did not discuss fertility risks of taking the medication, despite my interest of having future children. And then also half of them had a higher target of over 1,000 level of testosterone, which is fairly high. I think the important thing to realize here is that none of the platforms actually were using urology guidelines for assessing what they considered to be a low testosterone, a goal testosterone, and a decision to manage testosterone levels.
I mean, this, the results are surprising because you want these clinics to kind of, you know, do better, do what's right for the patient. But, you know, we live in the world where, you know, and this is kind of why we do this show, you know, it's, you know, there's a lot of things that men want to take care of themselves, right? And sometimes, you know, going to the doctor may not feel like the most comfortable thing. And a lot of these clinics offer a very attractive, it almost feels anonymous in many ways, of seeking care. And one thing that guys want to do is that, you know, look, you know, testosterone, you hear all the positives of it. But as Justin says, there's a lot of important things to consider, its effect on fertility. Also, just the risk in general with it. You just have to be informed. There's good risks and there's, you know, as we kind of talk about in another episode, just talking about risks and benefits in any sort of treatment that you undergo. And so that's why if you get these, you know, when I provide it, and I know you do too, when we provide advice and guidance to our patients, we really go over all of this. It's not just, hey, all right, sounds good. Here's your testosterone. Good luck. And, you know, we'll see how things go. So it was a really nice study, and I think it was really needed, especially in the times that we're in now.
Yeah, I think you summarized it really well. I think the bottom line is, and listen, my experiences with these telemedicine companies was actually delightful. They were very efficient. They were cordial. It was a good experience. But, you know, when you're looking at what the recommendation was, there was a gap in what they recommended versus what we would recommend. And I think at the end of the day, you have to realize that telemedicine is good. I'm not bashing telemedicine. I think telemedicine is here to stay. And it really helps exactly like you said. A lot of guys don't want to come into the office to talk about their ED, their low libido, because, you know, it's a very stigmatized thing. And that's why we made this podcast. So there's this ease of, you know, anonymity almost, or true privacy through telemedicine that you don't get in your clinic. And you also have, you know, increased access to care and convenience. You don't have to leave your work. You don't have to, you know, leave the kids. You can get that. So there are benefits to telemedicine, but I think the point is that really when it comes to testosterone replacement therapy, there's a lot of great things, and we give testosterone to a lot of patients, but testosterone therapy is not for everyone. And if you're interested in fertility specifically, it's really not a good option. And, you know, talk with your local healthcare provider before, you know, doing anything that you may regret.
I think that was well put. I think we can kind of transition and, you know, this week, our episode, our guest is a good friend of ours. And his name is Dr. Kenny Okeke, and he's an anesthesiologist. And we got to know him while we were over, you know, with our training at University of Miami. And now he practices in the South Florida area. But, you know, one of the things that guys want to know about, or just people in general, is just like what to expect when you undergo anesthesia. Right, Justin?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's one of those things that's still a mystery for a lot of people. It's almost, and I think we talk about it almost being like magic, yeah, in the episode, because it's really pretty crazy, the anesthesia. And, you know, it's very interesting because most of the time for a lot of guys getting surgery, they only have one interaction with their anesthesiologist, and it's the day of surgery. So there's a lot that most people don't know about anesthesia that maybe they should know. I think we got a lot of interesting answers to some questions that I was dying to know about. And I think some of our listeners were too.
Yeah, absolutely. And also this was one of the ones that we taped at SMSNA. So it was done under the live setting, and it was a really nice chat, and it's good times. So shall we jump into it?
Let's do it. Enjoy, guys.
All right. So we're here with another one of our live episodes, and yeah, we are very privileged to be joined by Dr. Okeke, one of our dear friends, who's an anesthesiologist. Why don't you introduce yourself?
How you guys doing? I'm Dr. Kenichuku Okeke. Everybody calls me Kenny. I trained at University of Miami with these two guys, so happy to be here, and thanks for having me.
Dude, great being here with you. It's good catching up.
Yeah,
good seeing
yeah, yeah.
you. So let's start off. So we're going to be talking about anesthesia because I think anesthesia is really cool because it's almost like magic, right? Like you go to sleep, you time travel almost, and you're not in pain where people worry about pain. So like it's a big mystery box for a lot of people, including a lot of actual other doctors. So let's try and figure out and answer some questions for patients from a patient perspective. I'm sure I'm going to learn, Kevin's going to learn something. So like, let's start off general. What is anesthesia and really how does it work?
Yeah, so it's actually very interesting too, because everybody that goes for surgery, they've talked to their surgeon, you know, a couple times, and meeting me for the first time, this is the only part of the surgery they're worried about. Because, you know, basically, I'm keeping you alive, technically, throughout the surgery.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And you have no control over it.
Yeah.
Like, basically, the scariest thing is that you lose control.
Yeah.
And I went for surgery the year after I finished residency, and that was the first time I felt it. I know I was going for surgery, and I was like, oh, wow, we'll have zero control in a couple minutes. But the definition of anesthesia is just that. It's a state of controlled and temporary loss of sensation and awareness for medical purposes. So the point is to for you to be unconscious, take away your pain and consciousness throughout that period of time you're getting surgery.
Gotcha. And you make a good point. I feel like Justin and I, we go see our patients and they're like, yeah, you talk to us. Where's the anesthesia?
Yes, always. They're like, we don't care. We talk to you enough.
So, you know, I think one of the things that we learned from a surgeon perspective, but I think listeners would really benefit from is that when you're undergoing a procedure, there's actually different types of anesthesia that you can get. So why don't you kind of go over the different types?
So I'm going to break it to easy to understand. I'm going to break it down in three categories. There's the most common one that everybody knows is general anesthesia. This is like basically the medication that we give block your central nervous system. So there's three important steps in it. You have induction, where we give you the medication, the maintenance period, and then the emergence when you wake up. They usually, in training, they taught us like the A's of anesthesia, which were amnesia, where you don't remember anything.
Great.
Analgesia, where you're supposed to take away all the pain.
Great.
Anxiolysis takes away the anxiety, and that's kind of like right before the surgery. Mm-hmm. You kind of want to mellow them out. We give them like a little medication to relax them.
Yeah.
And then you have a muscle relaxation just to kind of block the muscles so you don't move during the procedure. Then you also have regional anesthesia, which is your epidurals for like pregnant patients.
Yeah.
You can have spinal anesthesia that you do for like a lot of bone surgeries, orthopedics, where it kind of just, you put a needle in their back, give them medication in their spine, and they have no feeling from the center of their chest to the bottom of their feet.
It's amazing.
Very weird feeling that I've been told, but I've never had an epidural myself. But I've been told it's a pretty interesting feeling. Then you have something called monitored anesthesia care.
Yeah.
So to the everyone else, they would know it as like twilight sleep,
right.
IV sedation.
Yeah.
These are the type of anesthesia that you get during like a colonoscopy.
Right.
You know, we do a lot of IV sedation in the office for little procedures or plastic surgery and things like that.
Mm. Great. I mean, that explained a lot because I think that a lot of people, they go in and they're like, I don't know what the hell is going on. And I love the fact, like, listen, people get scared, but the thing with the A's that you mentioned is what you're doing is you're literally preventing all the bad things that come with the surgery from happening to you, right?
Like, you're
not going to feel anything. You're not going to be in pain. You're not going to be anxious. You're not going to remember anything. That's the dream, right? Yeah. Like, that's literally it. You want to wake up, you want to feel okay.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, I have a very corny joke that I normally say. I guess I'm going to say it.
Because,
you know, as an anesthesiologist, I have, 30 seconds for the patient to feel comfortable for me.
Yeah.
So I tell them, like, hi, my name is Dr. Okeke. I'm going to make you feel okay.
Oh, God.
Take the pain away. Corny joke. But, you know,
it's good. Like, it's
people,
good.
People are so nervous, they laugh at it.
Yeah.
So that's all.
Nice. So, you know, obviously there's a lot of benefits and anesthesia is a great thing and you need it for surgery, but there are inherent risks, just like anything. So what are some of the major real risks of anesthesia?
So the biggest risk that I tell every patient is something called PONV. So that's postoperative nausea vomiting. Now, you may not think that is that serious, but these are things that like keep people in the hospital, you know, for a day or two for an outpatient surgery. And if you ever felt nauseous before, just imagine feeling nauseous for like hours on a time that doesn't go away. So ironically, the most common risk factors are women, if you're not a smoker, If you suffer from motion sickness, and if you've had postoperative nausea vomiting before.
Right.
So that's like the biggest one that we always tell everybody. Then you have like your more serious risk, which would be like allergic reaction.
Okay.
You can have effects on the heart if you have bad heart disease. So, I mean, the worst point would be like heart attack.
Okay.
Regurgitation of food, like aspiration.
Yeah.
And you can get like blood clots, like a pulmonary embolism.
But so those big things are very small. Like we're talking like less than 1%.
Yeah, very small. So most of the time I don't even explain those things.
Yeah.
Those last three are things that I would have to explain to a family as for a patient in the ICU.
Gotcha.
Going through cardiac surgery. But the most thing people should just worry about is like nausea.
So it sounds like for the nausea part, like I know a lot of patients will bring that up and they remember. Yeah. Is there any
that's something that you won't forget?
Yeah, and they always ask.
They always tell me. Please take care of my nausea.
Right. If they do have nausea or a history of nausea, can you do something to try to alleviate it a little bit more aggressively?
There's a multitude of things. They call it like a multimodal medication.
Uh-huh.
So we look at the risk factors. Then you can either pre-medicate the patient before surgery.
Yeah.
Certain things that we kind of give, they have like a little patch, scopolamine patch that patients are accustomed to. That kicks in before the surgery and lasts for like almost a full day. And then we give certain medications right when surgery starts at induction, like I said before.
Yeah.
And then right before they wake up. So you're getting three different types of medications to help with the nausea before you wake up. So that's like those are the kind of things that they kind of battle, and they kind of made it like part of routine care for that. Yeah.
So that's something I'm learning. I didn't even know that terminology. POV.
I mean, it's something that you surgeons don't ask about it. They're just
are you canceling the patient? Yeah.
Is the patient up yet? Like, what's up?
But on that note, so PONV, so right, we're worried about the nausea and vomiting afterwards. Mm-hmm. The things that we tell a patient, you know, in the pre-op, like when they see him, was like, you know, one of the things is, look, you're going to have to like stop eating and drinking at midnight the night before.
Yeah.
All right. So is that related to that or like?
That's actually a good question. It's actually not really related to that.
Interesting.
But however, if you do have nausea beforehand, you know, you might be more likely to vomit. But the reason that we don't eat, they have fasting guidelines, 2, 4, 6, 8 is like kind of what they teach us. And the reason for that is because when you eat a lot of meals, it's based on how you, our system is based on how quickly the food digests.
Okay.
So if you're eating them, if most of the time we say if you have a morning case, don't eat after midnight.
Right.
So first case is usually at 7 o'clock, 7:30. For big meals, your stomach hasn't digested that yet.
Yeah.
Even if you don't feel hungry, hasn't digested.
Right.
And I mean, you guys know, I can't tell you how many surgeons are like, oh, you know, 6 hours, you know, why not? But even in 6 hours, if the patient vomits, whose fault is that?
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And it's happened almost every time, like unless it's an emergency.
Right.
If the patient has not followed the MPO guidelines, nothing per os. You know, they either vomit when we give the medication for like induction to put them to sleep.
Yeah.
So before we even put the tube,
right?
Like their esophagus kind of opens and then they can regurgitate anything. Or when they wake up. Luckily, if it's on when they wake up and the tube's not there, the airway's protected.
Right.
But the biggest thing that we're worried about is if they vomit, it goes into their lungs.
That's probably.
If you don't vomit, it goes into the lungs. There's still not concrete evidence on how to handle that. Some people say don't give antibiotics. The guidelines say don't give antibiotics. But you kind of just do supportive care from there. And that's kind of what you don't want to deal with and tell family, oh, you know, you went for a routine surgery. But now you have food in your lungs.
Yeah, I mean, listen, no one wants any of that in their lungs. So just to like reiterate that, because it is like one of the big sticking points is like, don't eat before your surgery because you're gonna potentially put yourself at risk for vomiting and the word aspirating, right?
Yeah.
Now, I think the other thing about that is like, people think it's just food, but like, you know, coffee, water, drinks, you can't have that drink, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, man, these ones are so funny because when you ask them, they're like food, but when you ask them, like, did you eat or drink? They'll be like, no, or something like that. Oh, I just had a little bit of water. And then if they're with somebody, the other person will kind of tell the truth. They're like, no, it's kind of like, you know, like, you can never trust really how much they say. So even if they drink like a little bit, if it's not with medications, you kind of just have to take your judgment and go the safer route. But what people get confused about what you're talking about is coffee and black coffee. Yeah. So like with black coffee, you can drink that 2 hours beforehand. It's almost like clear water. But if you add any type of dairy yogurt, creamer, it's like, you know, you're pushing 4 hours. You got the weight.
I mean, what's going to happen is your case is going to end up being canceled. I mean, we had a guy come in who ate chicken nuggets and said it was 2 hours before. I was like, chicken nuggets don't fit that bill, you know?
I think the funniest one when I was at the hospital, the guy's like, yeah, I just had a steak dinner because I wanted to prepare myself for surgery.
Dude, I honestly love that. I respect it, but you're,
I was like, okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just important, right? Like people don't understand why they can't eat. Yeah. We're not trying to torture you. Mm. We're literally trying to prevent you from
yourself. It may seem like that, but we're not, you know.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, for the patient side, I kind of get it. Like, they've been waiting months for this surgery.
Yeah.
Like, this little mishap, they'll be delayed and the emotional stress from it. But, you know, the safe side, you'll be alive. Yeah. So,
you know, one of the things that you do when you first see the patient, you guys really go over the medications that they're taking. Are there any medications that, you know, a patient can take that may affect their anesthesia or, you know, change their experience or something that you're worried about?
So, I mean, there's a multitude of medications that that can affect a patient, like whether they're on blood pressure medications. Mm. Now that we're like in a holistic area, there's a lot of herbal medications
that's very interesting.
Yeah, that, like, you know, a lot of people take vitamins. You know, when we were in training, they usually called it like the herbal G's. Like ginkgo biloba, ginger, all of them cause like a risk of bleeding.
Yeah.
Yeah. So kind of just trying to go over with these patients, like to tell them to not take it beforehand. And then other, I won't call them medication, but you know, like certain drugs also can affect the way anesthesia is used, as well, like cocaine and things like that.
Yeah. And that's what we're going to get into in a second. Mm-hmm. But and this is all going to go into the important thing where honesty, just like in any other aspect, like when you see us in the office, you really want to be honest. You want to tell us what you're doing, what you're taking. And like, when it comes to things like you can't lie. Like, tell us what supplements, tell you what things, because exactly like that, like, because you may say hold it for a week or hold off on doing it. But then coming to drugs, exactly, like cocaine, marijuana, things like that. How did these things impact your anesthesia experience?
So when I talk about these things, these are also where, you know, you have a couple funny stories, because a lot of patients don't want to tell you what they're taking.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, you know, what you do on your own time, you know, for a good time is up to you.
Right.
But when it comes to cocaine, that's something that's like a zero tolerance policy. You can cancel it right away. And sometimes the way the system's done now, usually a lot of these patients go through like a pre-screening period. So some of it's called like patient has a history of cocaine use and things like that. So we know to ask them. And multiple times when I ask them, you know, they'll lie, but they'll say, no, I didn't. But that's when I kind of go like, okay, so it's good that you didn't take cocaine. Because if you did, that's literally one of the, you know, drugs that can kill you.
Yeah.
Because it closes the vessels of your heart and you can get a heart attack. So, I mean, I say it calmly, just like, okay, good. Like, congratulating them that like, you didn't take your cocaine today. So then usually like 5 minutes before the surgery comes back, the nurse is like, oh, doctor, they just want to tell you something real quick. So I know, I remember last time, I think I was like, this patient was supposed to get an orthopedic surgery. He comes back, he's like, man, you're so cool and young. I mean, you're like brother to me. Didn't really know me.
Yeah.
He's like, I just want to tell you now, I just took a small bump. I was so nervous, I didn't take a bump. That's okay, right? I like appreciate but telling me that, but your surgery's canceled.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. And like, and when you're saying like, I think it's important, like for cocaine, it's like not that day. It doesn't necessarily mean you took it that day, right? Like, what's the time frame?
Yeah, I mean, but cocaine usually leaves your system within like 12 to 16 hours. So usually the instructions usually are pretty simple. It really says, don't take cocaine the day before your surgery or the day of.
Yeah.
So you almost have like you have like a 24 hour window to do your cocaine before the surgery, but you know.
The bottom line is just don't do cocaine at all. But, you know, I think it's just like an important point. I'm not saying like some, I don't want someone to come in and be like, well, I did cocaine yesterday, so I'm okay. Yeah. I'm going to tell you I didn't do my cocaine.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that's not how it works. Mm-hmm. And what about marijuana?
So marijuana is like, still, people still do kind of understand it. Like, what I've seen from it, it doesn't really change that much in the anesthesia purposes. What I've seen, though, however, for like the conscious sedation procedures, the IV sedation procedures, it increases what we call like a MAC. So that means the amount of anesthesia you need to basically get to a level of unconsciousness, you need a lot more medication to get there. Like the average person, I've definitely had to put a lot more medication like propofol or anything like that, just to kind of get them to where I need them if I know, or if they're a chronic marijuana user, which I usually don't find out until later. Right. And that's not really studied anywhere, but I've seen it from my experience.
I'm sure you've heard that.
Seen it from my experience. These guys are taking like syringes to calm
down. But that doesn't increase a risk potentially.
It doesn't really increase the risk, but I mean, you do have a bunch of anesthesia in your system now. And usually they wake right up, right afterwards. It's not anything that lasts long, so. And I'm not around to see if like 4 hours later, you know, they can't get up. But that's really the major thing I see in my marijuana too, so. Like they don't cancel any cases
I've never canceled
marijuana in the morning.
So, I mean, I think the takeaway point is that, you know, if you're about to go for surgery, just be honest with your doctor.
Yes, 100%.
Because, you know, we're not here to be like the police or anything like that, but, you know, it's just to make sure that you undergo your procedure safely.
Exactly.
I think that's the take-home point. But why don't we go to, you know, it's a day of surgery, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm the patient, and you're like, oh man, I'm undergoing general anesthesia, and I'm about to go to OR. Just describe to our listeners, you know, what it feels like to undergo anesthesia.
Yeah, so, like I said before, so let's take it as a first person time that's ever done it. They've already talked to their surgeon for, you know, however many weeks they prepare for the procedure. They come in, usually whether or not they're scared for the IV, that's not even the most major part of the surgery.
Yeah.
But things as simple as an IV.
Yeah,
right.
Oh, yeah. You're right.
Yeah, you have people crying, and it's like these are delaying the procedure. And it's interesting too, like even people have like full sleeves, tattoos. People that are most scared.
Freaking out.
So once they kind of get through that process, I kind of tell them like the IV is usually the most difficult part of the procedure for you because it's the only one that you're going to feel.
Yeah.
Yeah. So kind of once the IV's in, I kind of smooth them out. We give them, if they're, you know, young and healthy, we give them something called what Versed. Uh-huh. It's almost kind of like a liquid Valium or Ambien. That definitely calms them out.
Gets you chill.
We usually call it like the don't care medicine because right when they get it, they, you know, you can tell the whole affect changes.
The eyes, you can see the eyes.
You know, they're telling us all these stories that they would never tell anybody.
Right.
don't worry, I've kept to the grave, but I've heard a whole bunch of things. And after that, it's pretty much smooth sailing. We go through the part of like induction, giving medication where once that's given, within 2 seconds they're asleep.
All right.
We drop the tube in. Usually the patient should not feel anything throughout the procedure. For them, I always tell them, it's gonna feel like a blink.
And they don't feel the tube or anything, right?
They don't feel anything. So it'll feel like maybe 5 seconds for them, and then a lot of patients wake up not knowing the procedure happened.
Right.
But then when they get the soreness from the procedure, they're like, okay, I can see it was done.
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going in chill.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? That's like the thing.
You're going in
chill.
I mean, like I said, like a lot of people are afraid. I've seen people crying because they don't want the anesthesia. But I was like, this is an elective surgery. Like, you guys want to do this.
Yeah.
I was like, but, you know, it is what it is.
Everything's going to be okay.
Exactly. Yeah, you should get a shirt. you're going out on a Friday night.
Put on my name tag.
Yeah.
And you have like an okay.
I think I had a name tag with that.
Yeah, dude. But so the memory thing is very interesting because mm-hmm. I think that's something that people always wonder. Like, and you brought that up. You know, at what point do people not remember? Like, you're getting chill. I think most people remember that part.
Yeah.
But I've had anesthesia several times before, and I remember getting to the OR and then I'm in the
packing space.
So like. Yeah. What percent, like, is that usually how it works, or like?
Yeah, so what you're talking about is we call like intraoperative awareness. And it is, waking up during the middle of the case is so rare. It's like a minute percentage. And the only ones that's common for is like obstetrics, like a C-section.
Yeah.
Those are like
I thought they were awake anyway.
Well, if you had to do a stat C-section, kind of don't want to give them too much anesthesia because it can increase bleeding and things like that. Trauma surgery, where you're not giving that much anesthesia because the patient's like bleeding and you don't want to decrease the blood pressure. So things like that. But most people don't even remember the operating room.
Yeah.
So like that medication I told you about, Versed, has something called retrograde amnesia. So I'm sorry, anterograde amnesia. So you don't remember anything other than, you don't remember anything from that point on. Like you're talking and you're fluid, but you don't remember the conversation or anything. So
you're basically blacking out.
Yeah, blacking out, but you're still talking.
I mean, I think that's like the biggest fear that most patients have. They're just like, man, I'm going to wake up and like, I'm going to see like their faces. They're like, I don't want to do it because that's
because there's too many things that happen before a patient could wake up. You know, they their blood pressure goes up, their heart rate goes up, the machine starts beeping. You know, the surgeon can't get like the type of feel that they're looking at because the patient may need more medication. So there's too many things happening before that. A lot of patients will say, oh, I woke up before during a colonoscopy, but that is completely different because, you know, it's IV sedation and it's not full general anesthesia.
I mean, so the procedure's done. I teleport to the PACU.
Teleport.
You know, that's what it feels like, right? You're just like, you're teleporting, time traveling to the PACU. The PACU is the post-anesthesia care unit. And so, is that right?
Yeah, post-anesthesia care
unit. I always just been saying PACU, that's pretty good. But I'm learning, okay. But I'm a patient. What is to be expected once you come out of anesthesia? Obviously, you mentioned the nausea thing.
Yeah.
But other than that, like, what is being monitored? What are you to expect when you're done with your anesthesia experience?
For this, I would probably do this like, it's like pretty age-dependent. So for like a young person, very groggy, especially if it's your first time, just be very, very sleepy. And usually the PACU is there for that kind of, they want to be able, you to be able to rest, be able to walk, use the bathroom. So they kind of have like a criteria that they have before you leave. And you got to be able to just follow commands, simple things like that. They usually keep the average person in the PACU for like an hour if it's like an outpatient surgery, depending on that. For older patients, they just have, just naturally, just because of their decline in health, they have like a longer time getting out of anesthesia. The older you get, they do have something called like chronic cognitive disorder post-anesthesia. The longest time can be for 3 months, but those are for patients over 70 with other comorbidities and other medical problems.
Very rare. Well.
Yeah, very rare.
Very rare, but
usually, usually sleepiness, we talked about the nausea, pain from the surgery itself.
Yeah.
Those are kind of things that you kind of expect.
So, you know, actually, I think this brings something up because a lot of patients will ask us, like, you know, what should I limit after surgery? So we talk about, like, you know, weightlifting, things like different activities that we restrict. But I guess one of the things that we never really go over, which I'm sure you do, is what kind of things should a patient avoid due to the anesthesia?
Avoid?
Right after, at least.
Like after.
I mean, usually to leave the PACU, we made sure that you can do everything you were able to do before you got to the hospital. So there shouldn't be really any limitations other than somebody driving you home.
Right.
Oh, driving. Important.
You
can't be driving yourself home, even an Uber. Because, you know, you might take an Uber and not wake up.
That's true.
Things these days. But the goal is of the PACU is to discharge you or have you leave the PACU the way you came in, minus the surgery. So I don't really tell them any limitations. The most common question is, oh, when can I eat normally? And if you're able to leave the PACU, usually they're giving you food in the PACU already.
So. Yeah. That's a good point. Driving is key, and then
very key.
Uber.
don't expect, but that's important, right? Because like we've had to cancel cases because people don't have ways to get home.
Exactly.
Right? I do the same thing too.
So they ask us, the patient can have a ride home. So usually, I tell them, you know, go to send them to an ER until they can get one, because you know you always want to play it on the safe side.
Absolutely.
Is there any? What else we got? I don't know.
I think we covered a lot of it, man.
All the anesthesia myths?
Any other things that people should know about for anesthesia that we didn't cover? Anything that you repeat to people?
Or like, what would you want to tell a listener who's about to go to the anesthesia?
If you're going to go for your surgery, just know that the anesthesiologist is the smartest person in the room.
You know, I think we always wonder what's going on behind the curtain, you know, but yeah, these guys are working away. They're working away.
Reading books.
They take
the most tests.
That's why they're smart, because they're reading a lot of books back there. You know, they're reading the Wall Street Journal.
You gotta diversify everything that you're
doing. No, these guys are working away just like we are, so it's good, dude.
All right, well, tell us where, thanks for coming, and tell our listeners where they can find you, or is there anything
If you guys want to follow my page, at Dr. KO, and I don't really have much other social media presence, but after this, you know, when you guys blow up.
Well, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for coming on, man. So thanks again to all of our listeners. As always, you can find us on all podcasting platforms, Spotify, iTunes. Download, subscribe, give us a review, 5 stars, always appreciated. You can follow us on all social media platforms, TikTok, Instagram, Twitter at The Man Up Pod. And also you can find us on our website, which is what, Kevin?
It's www.themanuppod.com.
All right. For us three, thanks for listening. Until next time, have a good one.